Today is June 11th, 2020. This is a Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Charles Butch Farabee, F-A-R-A-B-E-E. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Butch. How are you today?
Good, Tom. Thanks. Hope you're doing good, too.
Good. Thank you. Butch, may we have your permission to record this interview over the phone?
Yes.
Thank you. As I mentioned, this is a part five oral history interview. We left off in part four as you were leaving Lake Mead National Recreation Area, headed for Death Valley. And can you pick that thread up from there?
Okay, well, I was, I've been at Lake Mead for about a year and a half. And in those days, back in that, you know, the 60s and the 70s, if you were offered a transfer, the feeling was among the lower level people anyway, that you didn't turn them down because they were sort of hard to come by. And, you know, you didn't apply for jobs in those days. You were selected.
Huh.
And you could turn them down, but after one or two, well, I mean, not so much one, but after two or three refusals, you know, you started to be overlooked. And, you know, when you're a GS-7, brand new Ranger, not knowing which end of the gun to point at people practically, you didn't turn things down as a rule. So as I understood, when I was chosen to go over to Lake Mead, the superintendent from Death Valley had gotten hold of the superintendent at Lake Mead. You know, those guys work together pretty close geographically.
Uh-huh.
And as I understood it, they Death Valley asked for a list of three potential candidates that would fit into this spot, which was very isolated. It's called Wild Rose. It's not in the valley itself. It's not in Death Valley itself. Rather, it's at 4,000 feet in the Furnace. No, that's not right. In the, I guess it's the Panamint Mountains.
Okay.
And at that time, for years, you know, back in the 30s, 40s, and the 50s, it served as the summer headquarters. Everybody would move up to Wild Rose because it was at 4,000 feet, and this is before air conditioning. I think there was like one or two people left in the valley itself. So my there was one neighbor, a maintenance man and his wife.
Hey, Butch.
Yes?
Before you start talking about Wild Rose, can you speak for a minute to just what you were talking about, which was when you got an offer, you took it. I was just curious to know why that would be set up that way.
Well, I guess I don't have a finite answer for you, Tom. I think, you know, the electronics and the technologies were such that it wasn't that convenient, I think, to do advertisements. You know, today you can do all that sort of thing technologically right off the bat.
Right.
But in those days, you know, whatever that is, 50 and 60 years ago, you know, that sort of thing didn't exist. And the communications between, you know, the national office in D.C. and the regional offices and the parks themselves was, you know, relatively crude.
Right.
Everything is probably done by telephone. There might have been some sort of pre-fax that I can't remember. But, you know, I guess that's my answer. I don't have a finite.
Well, it seems kind of odd because just about the time you get to know kind of the geography and the players, it's time to go to a new park. it just seems like it might be, I don't know, as an outsider looking in, I'd assume you'd want somebody to stay around another couple of years, so that they could, you know, get a better handle on what was going on after they just kind of got settled in.
Well, I'm not suggesting that, people didn't move. I mean, a lot of people stayed in one spot for a long time.
Right.
But in this case, the guy whose place I took, Dick Powell, is the guy that caught Charlie Manson.
Okay.
And they needed somebody who could work, again, in an isolated area, a self-starter, somebody who didn't mind living in a place like that. And in fact, Wild Rose, at least in those days, was terribly isolated.
Okay.
And except for my maintenance man and his wife, who lived next door, there was nobody else that, literally for at least 30 miles.
And you had been isolated at Rainbow Bridge, and so
yeah.
You were familiar with that and done a good job there. So I could see why they would say, look, we need someone here. This guy's got the experience. Let's ask him.
Well, maybe. I mean, I guess I think you're giving me too much credit. I don't know that I did a particularly good job up at Rainbow Bridge, but I think I did a pretty fair job at Echo Bay at Lake Mead.
Okay.
But I think the bigger issue was they wanted somebody who had, you know, some law enforcement credential because of this, you know, Charlie Manson.
Okay, and, well, tell me about Charlie.
Well, of course, I mean, you know, everybody knows about Charlie, really, but he was caught by Dick Powell and Don Carney, principally. I mean, he was followed. He burned a front-end loader up at the racetrack, which is northern end of Death Valley. Somebody reported the fire, and so these two rangers, Carney and Powell, were very dogged about following him in terms of literally tracks in the road and talking to, you know, the few visitors that they might encounter. Did you see anything like, you know, did you see something? And so they ended up following this guy, but nobody knew, you know, the legend of Charlie Manson hadn't happened yet. It was just a bunch of hippies, a couple of adult male hippie men. And ultimately, they found a bunch of underage girls and runaways. But they'd all taken refuge. They'd taken over this abandoned ranch in the Panama Mountains. And at the time, it was not in Death Valley. But, you know, they burned up this pretty expensive front-end loader. I mean, it was, I don't know if it was brand new, but it wasn't an old front-end loader. So it was a pretty costly fire. And this was the summertime, and so these guys followed. They found where Charlie was, and they ended up making a little task force with the local highway patrol. Jim Purcell is one that I remember, and a couple of sheriff's deputies from, I guess it's Inyo County. Anyway, they had a task force of, you know, some rangers, some sheriff's department, some highway patrolmen, and probably, you know, maybe 10 or 12 law enforcement people went in. And they went in before light. There's actually a pretty good book written about this, written by the superintendent of Death Valley at the time, Bob Murphy, called Desert Shadows. But they went in before light, and, you know, they found the kids, the underage kids, and they found Charlie, Dick Powell and Jim Purcell, the higher patrolman, found Charlie scrunched up underneath inside of a kitchen cabinet. Now, this is an abandoned ranch, so the water didn't run. I don't know. I guess they brought in their own water. But he was scrunched in underneath this kitchen cabinet. And Charlie, I guess, is not a very big man, or I guess he's dead now, but wasn't a very big man. And apparently some of his long hair stuck out through the crack of the cabinet.
Hmm.
Well, they saw his hair. So they were able to find him. And at this point, you know, not for probably a week or more, was there any connection between Charlie and the Tate LaBianca murders in Los Angeles County? So anyway, they took all these people to jail and did whatever they had to do with the underage kids. And, ultimately, people started putting two to two together, and I think somebody overheard Charlie or one of the girls, the young women who were sentenced as well, talking about this murder, these murders in L.A. So anyway, they were able to tie that group of people to these murders. So they then, and then Dick and his wife were transferred to Lassen National Park. And I think, I always thought for years and years and years it was because he was getting some sort of threats from the family or something of that effect. But in fact, he told me one time that, no, it was just sort of his time to go, because he'd been there for a couple of years. So they wanted somebody to live out there, again, remote area, and who could take care of themselves, who had, I think, some law enforcement experience, and became even more important after they figured out who Charlie Manson was. And Death Valley in those days, maybe even to today, does attract a lot of people who want to be off the grid. Some are good people, some are bad people. But, in my year there, I encountered a little bit of both, but I did encounter some people that were pretty strange and pretty potentially dangerous, I think. But I had a good time in terms of exploring. I lived in a two-bedroom CCC, Civilian Conservation Corps, buildings that at some point they had pushed together to make a little bigger building, which also served as the ranger station, the Wild Rose Ranger Station. My wife and I lived there. I taught her how to use a shotgun. We kept the shotgun behind the front door of the ranger station. And, I patrolled. I mean, I just didn't sit around the ranger station because there wasn't very much visitation, one thing, because this is not on the main road.
What did Ann do?
Well, so pretty quickly, again, she's a very smart, organized self-starter. She ended up getting a job at Stovepipe Wells in the gift shop. And that amounted to, I'm trying to remember this, but maybe a 45-minute, almost maybe an hour drive from where we lived to Stovepipe Wells.
Wow.
And going there, she would pass Immigrant Ranger Station, which is where my boss lived, he and his wife, and I think a child at that time. Pretty small area, again, pretty remote. So she did that pretty early on. Now, I was only in Wild Rose for one day less than a year. It was 364 days. And the reason I remember this is that early on, right after I got to Death Valley, which would have been, I think, the June of 1970, and I think it was late June, pretty quickly thereafter, there had been this, the riot took place in Yosemite Valley, but there had been events taking place up to it at that point. And my wife and I went on a little trip up through California and up the Oregon coast. And in doing so, we stopped by the regional office in San Francisco, and I'd never met any of the muckety-mucks there. You know, and I was a GS-7. I was 26 or 7 years old. So maybe 28, I guess, perhaps, someplace in there. So the regional chief ranger, once we introduced ourselves, said that, you know, he had had a heart attack. He was in the hospital when I was transferred over. And he said, had I known that you were going to Death Valley, I would have stopped that and had you sent to Yosemite.
Hmm, interesting.
Because at this point, they're starting to think that they needed some, you know, law enforcement experience and training in Yosemite. But we went in and met the regional director, really a nice guy, and his name just slipped my mind, and he's just recently deceased. He said, you know, I can't move you right now, but I'll tell you, I will guarantee you, you will not be in Yosemite Valley, or Yosemite, and I'm sorry, in Death Valley, the entire year. So one day less than a year, I took a transfer to Yosemite Valley. And the job that I went to was as the shift supervisor, the night shift supervisor. And I went there thinking I was a GS-7. And in those days, the Park Service was going through this park technician, park ranger shuffle with the personnel series. And it may not mean too much to anybody, really, but I was an 025. And a technician was an 026, and an 025 was supposed to have had too much education, et cetera. So I went there as an 026. And that fight is still going on today, not so much the 026 part of it, but Rangers, this is in 2020 now, are being cataloged to the series. It's 1801, which is more as an investigator, and as a result, they're starting to lose the things such as resource management, search and rescue, and fire, and all that sort of thing. I don't know enough about it to get into any kind of a mention at this point anyway. But it is a big issue in 2020.
Yeah.
So anyway, I went to Yosemite.
So hang on. I'd like to know a little bit more about your year in Death Valley, if you're willing. Can you tell me what you remember about Bob Murphy?
Yeah, okay. I just put a crack in my mouth. I thought you were going to talk longer. Just a second.
No worries.
Well, Bob Murphy was, in those days, the superintendent was a GS-13. And today, the chief ranger is a GS-13.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, there's a grade creep and sort of things. But anyway, he's a GS-13, and he spent a long time in Yellowstone, for sure. And I don't know all of his history, but I do know that he gave me a lot of information when I was working on my first book about some rescues and things that took place in Yellowstone back in the late 30s and the 40s. And he was quite a cowboy and did a lot of the buffalo herding and that sort of thing, which I think he took a lot of pride in. But anyway, he was a nice man. You know, stature was fairly, he's probably fairly small in stature. He had a pretty good grasp on the field skills, I think. And again, I don't know much about his management history. The one thing that I didn't like about him is that I had my quarter horse in Lake Mead, and there was actually a corral at Wild Rose, and I thought it'd be a natural for me to bring my horse over. But in those days, staff could not have pets. You could not have a pet. You couldn't have a dog. You couldn't have a cat. You could have goldfish. You could have birds. If you were an employee of any national park area in the country. And there's all kinds of stories, if you talk to some of the old timers, about hiding their cats and people squealing on each other because I saw a cat in the window kind of stuff.
Yep.
So I thought, well, you know, it seems to me it'd be logical to bring my horse over as a patrol horse.
Oh.
But, you know, Bob said, no, it'll be interpreted as a pet. And I don't know if there hadn't been other people in the park, perhaps he would have let me bring it, but I'm sure he thought there'd be other people squawking about it.
Yeah.
So that was one of the things I didn't like. But I think overall, Mr. Murphy was a very nice person and probably a pretty good manager as well.
Mm-hmm. Who else?
I only worked for him for just one day less than a year.
Who else did you meet there that you would carry on friendships with for the rest of your career?
Well, Scott Conley was a seasonal ranger. I worked with him for a long time in Yosemite. Paul Fodor, F-O-D-O-R, was a ranger in Death Valley, and his wife, who was Japanese, and my wife and I would go down, and we'd literally sleep on their floor so we could watch a little TV.
Oh, wow.
Because we had absolutely nothing. We couldn't even get AM or FM radio during the daytime in Wild Rose, and certainly no TV. So, but you know, that was fine because my wife and I were still in putting the jigsaw puzzles together stage of our marriage because we hadn't been married too long at that point, a couple years. And so Paul Fodor, Dick Powell, who I didn't work with while I was in Death Valley, but I got to know him pretty well over the years. He ended up being the chief of safety for the Park Service for quite a few years. I have a lot of names almost on the tip of my tongue, but I'm having a little trouble knowing them out.
No worries. So what were some of the more memorable things that happened to you at Death Valley, do you remember?
Yeah, I remember a few. I mean, they weren't necessarily gigantic, although a couple, I guess, were. But, you know, I had a really nice four-wheel drive Chevrolet pickup half-ton that had a winch on the front, and it was raised up pretty high. It wasn't, it had a lot of clearance. And I've always told myself, you know, if you don't know what's out there to protect yourself, if you don't know what's out there to protect, how do you, you know, how can you protect it? So rangers ought to range.
Yeah.
So that's what I did a lot of. And somebody before my time had started putting together a scrapbook or a scrapbook's not the right term, but they had all of these 15 minute USGS maps in a book or a scrapbook, and it had a wooden cover and a wooden bottom to it.
Okay.
So, and over the years, you know, previous rangers and personnel had been adding things to this map. They would find a spring that's not on the map, or they'd find an old plane wreck that wasn't on the map, and, you know, a little bit of a road that wasn't on the map. So I always loved coming home in the afternoon or the evening whenever I'd get off of duty. You know, living out there by myself, I was sort of on duty 24 hours a day anyway.
Right.
But it wasn't like I was on the main drag either, but I would come home and open up my scrapbook or my map book, and I'd end up adding, you know, a half-mile dirt road that wasn't on the map, or some petroglyphs that I would find, which I did. I found several sites, although not particularly of any consequence, but they were there, that were unknown to the park. But, you know, I'd put them into this map, and so my, you know, people who would follow me, just like I was doing with people that I followed, would have some sense as to what's there and, you know, go take a look at it, and here's a spring that's nobody knows about kind of stuff. And so some of that stuff was sort of the biggie for the day. And then we had burros that would literally, this is the honest to goodness truth, you know, I bet you there are between 30 and 50 burros because, you know, the water source is real close to where we live, one of the water sources. And, you know, on any good evening, we could easily have 30 or 40 burros out in our front yard or front area anyway. And, of course, they'd make a lot of noise, and they weren't always there, but they would come back and forth, and, you know, they would eat their way up and eat their way down. And you had to have a fence so that anything that you grew, like a little lawn or something, they wouldn't take care of it. You know, they wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
But one day, my, you know, my wife and I were in the ranger station, and some visitor come in all excited, and apparently a coyote or some coyotes had killed one of these burros, but had left a baby burro. There's probably a name for that, right? What would a baby burro be, Tom?
A baby burro.
Yeah, I guess. had this baby burro, and so, you know, you're supposed to let sort of nature take care of its own kind of a thing, except that the burros were not indigenous to the area. But so my wife and I drive up there in my four-wheel drive government pickup with real high wheel wells, and I go out and make sure that the burro's dead, I guess. But in the interim, this baby burro goes up underneath the truck into the wheel well, thinking, I guess, that somehow, you know, the warmth of the engine and whatever, it duplicated the mother.
Oh.
So, you know, my wife is not going to let this lay. So we end up taking the burro home, and she raised it in our house. And she named it Sweet Pea. So, and, you know, she did, you know, the nearest town, Trona, I don't know, 60 miles or so, it was a good hour drive, had a little vet store, a little feed store, not so much a vet store, but a feed store. And she got some, you know, the milk and the formula that they fed calves. And she got that, and she got some rubber gloves and cut the tip off so that the baby burro, Sweet Pea, could nurse. So, you know, we literally had that burro in our washroom, you know, where our washer-dryer was. And, you know, of course, the burro would have scours, which means that it had diarrhea all over the floor half the time. But we ended up, and then when it was safe enough or, you know, weather was good and stuff, we'd have the burro be out in the front yard. And, of course, it would bray on occasion. So for a whole year, we had that burro. And while we were there, you know, there were a number of houses that were still intact that could be used by a road crew or somebody on a temporary basis. Well, we had a graduate student from University of Michigan. Her name is Patty Melman, who was working on a doctorate and in zoology, and she became our neighbor. And the she was doing her doctoral dissertation on social structure of Burroughs.
Oh, wow.
The reason she was living there. And when we left, when we transferred out, we actually gave it to her, and apparently she ended up taking it home with her. And although I didn't follow her career, I do know that she became a professor of zoology at maybe like Michigan State or someplace back there. So we had the Burrow, and then my next door neighbor, his name was Spike, S-P-I-K-E.
He's the maintenance guy?
Yeah, he's the maintenance man. And his real name was Charles, just like mine. But his nickname was Spike, so you got Spike and Butch out there holding Wild Rose down. And his wife, and it was common knowledge, although I don't think they went around bragging about it, but his wife, Emma, had been working at the Bunny Ranch in Beatty, which is where Spike met her. And for those of you who don't know what the Bunny Ranch was, which I don't think is in existence anymore, but it was a house to prostitution.
Okay.
And, of course, in Nevada, that's all legal. So my wife and she got along just like two peas in a pod. We did great, and we went back and forth and became pretty good friends. And so, you know, that was our living condition, and then we had the Burrow, and then a couple of events. One would be, from a search and rescue standpoint, one of the bigger events was Yubi Hebe Crater, which is quite a geological landmark in Death Valley itself, and it's about 500 feet deep, and it's, I don't know, it must be half a mile, if not longer or wider, in terms of the diameter. It's a volcanic crater, and there was a trail down into it, and there was just cinder all the way around, and the walls, some places, were vertical, and we got the ranger up at the other end got a call of two young boys, and they turned out to be about 11 and 12-year-olds, had scrambled up, had gone down to the bottom, and had started to climb up the wall, the cinder, wall, which would break loose in your hand, practically.
Yep.
They started climbing up there, and when they got to a certain point, one of the little ledges behind them broke off. So now they became trapped. And there really wasn't any real practical way to go up to them. And they were about halfway down. I mean, they were a couple hundred feet from the rim, but a couple hundred feet from the bottom as well. And literally, if they had fallen, the odds are very good that they would have been killed. So, I hear this over the radio, and, I'm red lights and sirens on my way up there. And that's probably an hour's drive, I guess, roughly. So three of us end up pulling off this rescue, which in the annals of National Park Service Search and Rescue was very unique. And, pretty unusual, because we dropped down from the top above these kids. We drove a axle, which had actually been designed for something like this. We pounded with a sledgehammer this axle into the cinder on the rim so that we could hook a rope around.
Right.
And Don Chase and I, who was my best friend, and he was working a split. He worked part of the year at Scotty's Castle and part of the year in the backcountry of Sequoia and Kings Canyon. And they used to do that for quite a few years, this split position. But Don and I, who had paddled around and did some diving together and traveled, went to different places in Mexico and stuff. So we go down, we rappel down and work our way down to a point where one rope is extended as far as it'll go, and that was probably 150 feet down, perhaps. And now these kids are still another 50 or 75 feet below us. So I end up putting the rope around me and belaying Don, and he rappelled, or actually lowered. I actually lowered him, I guess. I lowered him off of my body because I wedged myself into a little rivulet where over the years the water had made this little tiny gully, couple of feet. So I was able to brace my back against one side and my feet against the other side, and then lowered Don down to where he could get to these kids. So I'm holding him, and I'm at the bottom of this rope, which is tied off to this axle, a motor vehicle axle. And he's talking to these kids, and one kid, and so what he's going to do is he's going to lower them down to where somebody at the bottom can, get to them safely. So one kid, he did that. And I'm holding him. He's holding the kid. There are no anchors except at the very tippy top. He lowers this one kid down. The second kid is afraid, doesn't want to go. So Don, in order to, call his bluff, said, well, okay, I'll see you later then, something to that effect. And, the second boy said, well, wait a second, So Don ends up lowering both of these kids down one at a time. And then I belay Don back up to me. He's scrambling and I'm pulling, and we get up to this little gully, which, if you looked at this whole thing, you'd say, holy moly. I mean, you guys are really either very stupid or very brave. And it's mostly very stupid. And so then we're able to Jumar and scramble our way back up to the top of this rim. And this took all afternoon, and there's, several hundred people watching this whole thing from the other side. And, that was really a pretty interesting rescue. And, in today's climate, I mean, you just did it, and okay, so what's for supper now? I'm going to go home.
Right.
No big deal. Probably didn't even do a report. If we did, it was like a little handwritten thing. So, I think about it, I don't think we had to do the report. I think another ranger had to do the report, maybe.
Okay.
So, that was just, an interesting day, but there weren't that many of them. A lot of it was just patrolling, and the one time the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Office had been tracking some domestic terrorists in L.A. County, and they've been following them by air, and they were following them at night, and they lost them in traffic on their way up, and they ended up probably coming into Death Valley. So they brought up a team, and I ended up spending a couple of days with them going out and looking in some of the off-the-wall places, both in the park and outside the park, where potentially these guys could be. And we found a spot where they had actually been using high-powered automatic rifles and probably like a bazooka, where they had been, practicing, their marksmanship and stuff, because it was in a very rugged part of the park where it was so isolated that no one would ever hardly hear any, rifle rounds or even this bazooka.
Right.
So, that was kind of fun for a couple of days. And since I'd been a Tucson policeman and had worked a felony car for Tucson for a couple of years, I could speak the language a little bit better than a lot. So, let's see. That's probably the real biggies. For those who've never been to Wild Rose, it's really a very interesting area. And it's also, you pass it on your way up to two little campgrounds that are dry. One's called Mahogany Flats, and the other one is, oh, Well, no, I think Mahogany Flats is at the top, and there's another small one in between.
Hmm.
And then the road, there was a road that went all the way up to, not the top of the range, but close to it, which had a radio repeater in it. And it took care of the radio repeating for the county as well as the park. And that was part of my job, was to make sure, you know, to keep track of who was around. And, of course, there was a gate on that thing. But one night my wife and I drove up there in the government pickup, and then we hiked to the top of Telescope Peak, which is the highest point in Death Valley.
Nice.
And I was still thinking about, you know, flying, so I had this brand new, big, almost a boombox size radio with me that could get all the radio traffic from Los Angeles International.
Oh, wow.
So we slept on the tippy top, beautiful, you know, you could see forever all the way around.
Wow.
And then, you know, I would lay there and listen to the, you know, approach and departure controls out of LAX, if not elsewhere as well.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, you sort of had to make your own entertainment. And in my case, you know, I like to explore and wander and do things in those kinds of places. So it wasn't all bad. It was a lot of fun in many ways.
Yeah, sounds like it.
So.
Huh. And so at 4,000 feet, did you get winter snow a little bit?
Yeah, actually, we got snow, and you know, not all that often, but it wasn't totally alien to us either. I've got some nice photos of Death Valley, or no, Wild Rose, with snow on the sign that says Wild Rose Ranger Station.
Okay.
And in fact, that, you know, that probably led me to one of my more interesting adventures, which was to take that four-wheel drive with the winch on the front. And I didn't have any, I think I might have had chains, but I was probably way too lazy to put them on. But I probably had them in the truck. But I ended up driving all the way up to the high campground, which I think is called Mahogany Flats. And then there's another one below that I can't remember its name. But I drove up there, and of course there's nobody there,
mm-hmm.
but I end up driving into this campground, and I'm going literally through at least a foot of fresh snow, maybe
wow.
even deeper. And no one's ever said I was very smart. I ended up getting stuck a little way into this campground, and I couldn't back out. I couldn't do anything. I couldn't go forward, but so I had to get the winch out. And I winched myself all the way through this campground by, you know, directionally. I would winch 25 feet and then be able to put the winch a little different direction and winch myself, you know, all the way around. That probably took me a couple of hours to do that. And, you know, of course, I'm not going to call for help. And I don't know that anybody really could have helped me too much at that point anyway. So, yeah, that's a long answer to your question. We would get snow up there, but there wasn't enough traffic to worry about it. In those days, we still, I don't know what they do today, but we had to keep track of these big 55-gallon drums of water. And there'd be these signs, you know, on the main highways that would say radiator water half a mile ahead. Something like that. And that was part of our job, was to make sure, at least to double check and see what the levels of these tanks were. And I don't think that we personally put water in them. I think they had a tanker, you know, one of the maintenance guys would come out periodically and fill these water containers up. But that was a big deal in the days when, you know, radiators were much more susceptible to overheating.
Right.
And, you know, even with air conditioning on, there's a lot of long-distance, slow-upgrading parts to that park where if you're not careful, you can easily overheat. And in the summertime, you know, that could be deadly.
Right.
So that was part of our job, was to keep track of those.
And were you thinking, okay, I talked to those guys in region in San Francisco, and they said they were going to bust me out of here. So were you thinking you were going to get a job transfer? Or did it come as a surprise when you got an offer to transfer to Yosemite as a ship supervisor?
Well, you know, Tom, I'm not sure that I actually remember that. I suspect that I was going to go to Yosemite.
Okay.
I don't think I was all that surprised that it took place within a year, but I don't think I was counting on it either. I don't have a definite answer for you. I just think that it was a little bit of a surprise, as well as sort of a, I think it's going to happen, but I'm not going to bank on it yet.
And when it did happen, were you like, yep, I'm there? Or did you stop and ponder it for a while?
No, I didn't ponder it. I mean, I was ready to go.
Okay.
I mean, there was never any question that we weren't going to go there. Now, did I miss Death Valley a little bit? Yeah. And, you know, just like Lake Mead, when my wife and I drove into Lake Mead from Tucson and up to Echo Bay, you know, we were a little, you know, skeptical or nervous, because there isn't much out there in many ways. But when we left a year and a half later, we were terribly sorry to leave, because we enjoyed it thoroughly. And it's a really interesting area. There's lots going on. There's a lot of places to explore. And there are a lot of things that you just don't recognize until you're actually there and play with it for a while.
Well, it sounds like both of you are able to make lemonade out of lemons, if you will. Wherever you land, you enjoy it. You anchor in. You get, you know, Ann gets a job. You go exploring. It sounds great. But I guess I'm thinking that part of the job was that you understood this was going to lead to something else.
Yeah, but I didn't think it was going to lead to any kind of upward mobility. I just thought it was going to be a different park.
Right. That's kind of part of the territory is, okay, I'm working at this park and I'm going to get to know it and serve it as best as I can.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to move to another park.
Yeah. Right.
Okay.
Okay. You know, and I'd only been to Yosemite a couple of times and didn't know it very well, but I did know that there was a lot going on there. I didn't recognize how much was going on there until I got in the middle of it, of course.
Okay.
So I had in retrospect, an interesting time in Death Valley. One other incident that comes to mind that I ought to share.
Please.
To put the final nail in, you know, just how stupid I am category. When I was on the trail crew in Sequoia and Kings Canyon, I got to be for the last couple of years, the summers, I got to be using the explosives. You know, I could set the dynamite, use the blasting caps and set them off with the electrical generator and stuff.
Uh-huh.
So it was all self-taught, all on-the-job training, no formal training, no nothing. So, you know, I had some sense as to dynamite. So I'm in Death Valley. Of course, there's a lot of, in those days, a lot of mines.
Yeah.
Open shafts, open tunnels and adits. Some of them had been explored, but in those days, back in the 60s at least, there were still things that the miners had just basically dropped, walked away from, you know, 40, 50 years before.
Right.
And with my habit of exploring some of these very, very minor dirt roads, I'd end up going to places where, you know, some of these things, you know, there hadn't been many people there for 20 or 30 years.
Right.
So I find a tunnel out by Dusenberry Point. point. There's a little ghost on there, which whose name I forgot at the moment. And I find this tunnel, and I've had a report, or somebody's reported finding a box of dynamite there. So I'm able to find this box of about a half a crate or a half of a box of, you know, dynamite that had been weeping, which means that the nitroglycerin is coming out of the sticks.
This isn't Ballarat, is it?
No.
Okay.
No, I got stories about Ballarat, too. In fact, I got another story for you.
All right. Oh, good.
Really is more important. But the so here's a box of dynamite. It's way out in the middle of nowhere. I get on the radio. I call down, and I ask, you know, one of the rangers, so how do I get rid of this dynamite? Well, burn it. That's what they told me. So I think I went back to my ranger station. I got some diesel oil. Took the diesel oil back there. Now, this is all taking a whole afternoon or so. I get the diesel oil, and I soak this whole box of dynamite with this diesel oil. And I walk out about, not, it can't be very far. It couldn't be more than 50 feet. But there's a big boulder about the size of several refrigerators, I guess. And I take a car fuse for accidents, you know, a fusee.
Yeah.
And I pop it, and I end up throwing it into this box, and I'm able to get it there eventually, I guess, to burn it. And I'm not expecting anything to happen other than this dynamite will burn. Well, of course, it didn't burn. It just exploded. And fortunately, I was behind this boulder. And when it went off, you know, there must have been, you know, I don't know exactly, but I bet you there were 20 to 40 sticks of dynamite sitting in it. And I end up getting thrown to the ground. But fortunately, I am sheltered by this big boulder. And there aren't a lot of projectiles or anything, but I'm also recognizing, you know, gee, many Christmas, had I just assumed that this thing was going to burn like I was told it would by people that knew more about this than I did.
Like walked up with a match and just put a match to it, right?
Well, something almost that casual.
Mm.
But, you know, I still, to this day, think about how lucky I was that I wasn't more cavalier.
Yeah.
I was probably cavalier enough if it was. And again, by today's standards, you know, they'd have all kinds of, you know, we'd close the roads off and they'd have some sort of a way to.
Yeah, they would have brought out a blasting cap and a bunch of wire, and like the guy would have been a quarter mile away. And
yeah. It would have been done much more professionally than I did it, of course. I got the job done. I don't think it collapsed the tunnel. I don't think I even cared about that at that point. I was just lucky I was alive. But so Ballarat, you mentioned Ballarat, which was not in the park, which Ballarat's a little ghost town. There was one guy, I think, that lived there.
Ballarat was not in the park. Okay.
No, it wasn't in the park in those days.
And there was a caretaker living there.
Well, not so much a caretaker as much as there was somebody trying to make a little living.
Okay.
And they actually, if I recall right, you could actually stop in and get a hamburger at this little store. And, you know, I say there's one person. There might have been, you know, a few more, but it was virtually a ghost town.
Okay.
And the history was such that, you know, somebody had told me long before, you know, when I started going to Ballarat, that, you know, there were a bunch of stolen cars one time, and they buried them all out there. So there's all this mystique of sort of the Charlie Manson kinds of area where you're really looking over your shoulder to make sure what's going on. But since it wasn't in the park, it wasn't in the park. And so I would end up still going out there and patrolling it and Surprise City. Is that right? That sounds, it's in Surprise Canyon. Let's see. There's a little ghost town, which is really neat in this canyon. You have to walk into it to it now, but I could drive into it then. But I would, you know, even though it wasn't in the park, I still felt responsible for going out and keeping track of what's going on, et cetera, which I did. And I got to know the guy in Ballarat a little bit. Well, so this is, you know, the Woodstock area, or time rather, and they're going to have this big rock concert in Ballarat. And they put all these flyers out and notices in various newspapers and whatever for people to come to Ballarat. And, in, you know, in many ways it would have been very attractive because it was remote. A lot of hippies in those days, of course, you know, a lot of nudity and various little canyons and springs and things. And so this is a perfect place to have a rock concert. So they actually brought in a contingent, about a 25-man United States Park Police team from Washington, D.C. They brought in roughly 6 or 8 rangers from around the West. And so there might have been, and then I don't know exactly, but I'm sure that the county, as well as perhaps the higher patrol, I mean, everybody was gearing up to have this huge influx of people. So as it turns out, of course, nobody came. I mean, they gave a rock concert. Nobody came, basically. But one of the park policemen, you know, they had one of these guys had a wreck and flipped his car, and he's still paralyzed. He's paralyzed too today.
Ouch.
And my wife and I had, we had a couple of rangers, Jack Fields and George Buckingham were two, that my wife, we invited them over for supper one of these nights, and perhaps it was right after the, you know, the rock concert that didn't materialize, as sort of a celebration night. And in my two-way radio in those days was in the house was a base set, which meant that it was the size of a small bookcase and had a hand mic on top of it. And it was a place where you could actually sit down on top of it if you were careful.
Okay, so big unit.
It was a pretty good size two-way radio, and it was, you know, it was in my house. It was a base station, if you will.
Right.
And one of these guys, either Jack or George, sat down on this thing. Well, as it turns out, he was sitting on this microphone. So, you know, for half an hour.
Oh, no.
You know, the group of us, and there were probably 5 or 6 people in that room, and we weren't necessarily getting on anybody's case too much, but we were telling some gossip and probably things that we should not have been having broadcast. Well,
so this is an open mic.
It is an open mic, and as you know, after maybe a half an hour, literally after all this time, I start smelling ozone in the, you know, you can sort of smell the electrical burning. And I started thinking about this, and, you know, it seemed like forever that it took me to make that decision, but probably 15 seconds I recognized that we were sitting on this microphone, and we were in the midst, my wife and I were in the midst of telling about having gone to one of these nearby towns, and staying in a motel just to watch TV and have the air conditioning going, you know, for our weekend. And we had bed bugs. And we're telling this story, and we're about halfway through the bed bug part of it. And whoever's sitting on it, we get them off of there. And without missing a beat, the woman who was normally sort of a dispatcher, during the daytime, at least, in the valley, her name is Dorothy Shally, she ends up coming on the radio. And, you know, everybody in the entire park has been listening to this. Anybody that has a radio, because, you know, and you always had your radio on in those days.
Right.
My wife used to call it coitus interruptus. But so she ends up, without missing a beat, saying, well, come on. What happened with the bed bugs? And I think that we finished the story off, although probably pretty quickly. And we were certainly chagrined. And then for the next hour or more or some, you know, we're trying to think, okay, who did we badmouth? Who did we
Oh, no.
shouldn't have. And we finally decided that we were actually pretty okay. We didn't really spill the beans too much on anybody. But that was not a good thing. But this Ballarat concert that didn't come off was what was taking place all around the country. I mean, we were not unique in that regard. And that sort of led up to, you know, the that was sort of the era where, you know, you had the Yosemite riot that year. There were things taking place all around the country, and I don't know the exact chronology, but Kent State wasn't too far before that. Of course, Woodstock, you had all kinds of Vietnam War protesting, a lot of race riots. You know, women were burning their bras, draft cards were being burned. It was really a very, very tough time, unique. And, you know, with today's issues with Black Lives Matter and all the protesting that's going on, I couldn't make a comparison necessarily, but I do know that a lot of what was taking place in the 60s, the mid to late 60s, somewhat comparable to what's taking place today. So having said that, Tom, I think I'm done with Death Valley, at least until I go to bed tonight and remember something that was important. I don't know.
That was wonderful. That was, I love the open mic story. that's very fun.
It was embarrassing, of course.
Oh, of course. But that's what makes wonderful stories.
And I think there are very few rangers and probably not many policemen out there or other people who have microphones who haven't had somewhat comparable stories where they sit on their radio in the front seat of their car or something.
Sure, sure.
You know, that's fairly common.
Yeah. So who was it that asked you to come to Yosemite?
I mean, I'd have to look at the personnel papers to see who actually signed off on it. But the regional director is the one whose name I wish I could remember. I've seen him numerous times here in Tucson. He lived in Green Valley, actually, although he's now dead several years ago. Very nice man. But he's the one that I think pretty much guaranteed us coming to Yosemite, but I was always in, you know, I'll believe it when I see it kind of thing.
Right.
But in this case, between he and the regional chief ranger, they were looking for people to come to Yosemite or to be brought into Yosemite who had had some professional law enforcement training. And when the riot took place, and we can talk about this at some other point here. But when the riot took place in 1970, the first five rangers in the Park Service were going through what would turn out to be eventually the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center, but it was a Park Police Law Enforcement School in Washington, D.C. So the Park Service was just teeny tiny tip of the iceberg starting to get, you know, rangers into professional law enforcement training.
Okay.
And there were, you know, this of course is a guess on my part, but there might not have been more than a dozen or 15 rangers throughout the entire national park system. And remember that, you know, there weren't that many parks in those days, probably less than, you know, 200 or so. But or park areas, but you know, there were maybe a dozen or 15 rangers who had professional law enforcement training. Somebody might have been, one guy that I remember, Steve Wolf, had been a California Highway Patrolman. Daryl Stone had been a sheriff's deputy in Madera County. So there were, you know, those kinds of people. Butch Farabee had been a policeman in Tucson.
Right.
So there were those kinds of rangers out there, but there weren't many.
Okay.
And so anyway, I don't think I really totally answered your question. But
well, no, this is fine. What I was thinking is when you went to Yosemite, I want to introduce a couple people, and one is the superintendent, and the other is the doctor at the clinic. And these are people you know well and will work with well for many years ahead. So I guess I'm thinking, where were you assigned housing, or were you living outside Yosemite and commuting in? What month did you transfer over there?
So I arrived on June 21st, 1971. I'm pretty sure about that date, but it was certainly June 1971.
Okay.
And I lived in the valley. We were assigned a two-bedroom house, in Yosemite Valley. And I was, as I say, the night shift supervisor, and we took a U-Haul trailer. We loaded the trailer up. I got a ranger from Death Valley, Rocky McCrite, to help me move. I had to rent this U-Haul. They paid some expenses. I don't remember how that works exactly, but they paid expenses. But you could move yourself, but you could also get a professional mover to do it also.
Uh-huh.
And so we went from we went from Lake Mead to Death Valley to Wild Rose with a professional mover. But you could move yourself, and they would give you whatever a moving van would have cost. They would give that to you.
Oh.
And if your U-Haul trailer was less, then you could keep the excess.
Okay.
And it was perfectly legal. Lots of people did it,
mm-hmm.
depending on how much you wanted to work and that sort of thing.
Right.
And so we did that. I got a U-Haul trailer, not a truck, rather, and went to Yosemite Valley, moved into this two-bedroom house, very nice house, Mission 66 house, and right in downtown Yosemite Valley. And I could be at my office by walking from my house in less than a minute, or about a minute if I walk, kind of quickly.
Okay.
And I was within a block of the fire station, a block of the rescue cache, a block of the jail. So I was right in downtown Yosemite Valley. Now, what else did you ask me about?
What were your duties as night shift supervisor?
So anything that took place from a certain time, and this varies somewhat, but say from 4 o'clock in the afternoon to midnight or 1 o'clock, that took place in the valley, in terms of emergency response or fee collection, you oversaw. And in the summertime in Yosemite Valley, in those days, there were probably 6 or 8 permanent rangers that I oversaw, as well as another 20 or so seasonal rangers.
Okay.
So, law enforcement, search and rescue, rescue itself, although I wasn't at this point involved with the structural fire brigade, fires that would take place maybe once a week.
So Butch,
management.
Hang on, I'm thinking of this. Wait a minute. Suddenly, you've got about 30 people working for you, working under you. Did you get any training in management at all? Either
no.
No, it was just like, here you go.
Yeah, basically, that's right.
Wow.
And
who did you have to mentor you?
Well, I mean, not much, actually, Tom.
Okay.
At least not initially, no. I had a district ranger. His name was...
would have been your boss.
Yeah, he would have been my boss, Bill. I forgot. Nice guy. Common sense, sort of an old ranger.
Okay.
But had a lot of common sense. And in the middle, Yosemite Valley in those days, when I walked, the first week or two that I was in the valley, and I I would go out with somebody, and they, you know, that I worked with, a guy named Don Otterback comes to mind real fast. Bill Worthington is the district ranger that I couldn't remember.
Okay.
So, you know, I'd go out on, you know, ride along with them. I just didn't go out there right off that first night.
Right.
I mean, I had somebody that I went out, and they showed me where everything was, you know, where the bathrooms were and where the jail was and everything.
Okay.
But there were more felonies taking place in that valley per square inch or per square thing than I ever saw in the police department. Lots of drugs, lots of out-of-bounds camping, and lots of just, you know, drinking kinds of things. You know, you have to remember the era, though, too. A lot of counterculture, a lot of, you know, the hippie era. And the riot had taken place the year before. That sort of set the stage.
Was Dick Marks still superintendent, or had he moved on?
Marks was never superintendent.
Dick I'm sorry, not. Yeah, that's right. Wasn't superintendent. He was
chief park ranger.
Chief ranger, right? Was he still chief ranger?
Well, and actually, that's a little. That is not totally accurate. He was not the chief ranger. He was the staff park ranger.
Okay.
Which is a little different than the chief ranger. There was a chief ranger, I forgot his name.
Okay.
Moment. When I mentioned a long time ago the park technician and the park ranger series.
Right.
And there was this big move throughout the entire park system called FOST, F-O-S-T, which, had I thought I was going to mention this, I would have looked up what that acronym means. I used to know it. But it was a movement all throughout the entire agency to do certain things. And one of them, in addition to this 025, 026 kinds of grading and putting people in job series, was that Yosemite was under the unit manager concept. So the unit manager for the valley, who oversaw, and this wasn't totally all that good, but oversaw maintenance, interpretation, resources, and protection. And so he, in some ways, was also my supervisor. His name was Brian Harry that time. And Mather District and the Wawona District had the same units. I mean, they had their own little units. And so the head of that unit, like Brian was in the valley, and I'd have to think real quick, I guess, for the other two, but...
Well, this makes sense, because on large parks like this, where you have centers, I mean, I'm thinking Grand Canyon has the South Rim Village, it has the North Rim Lodge area, and it has the backcountry, it has the river, it has the different areas, and so you would have a unit manager oversee these unique, fairly large and fairly complex areas.
Well, and Grand Canyon had units, you know, Desert View Unit.
Right.
The South Rim, I think, had its own unit.
North Rim had its own unit.
North Rim with Rick Gale, yeah.
So it makes sense that Yosemite has different unit managers for different areas of what is a very large park. So.
Yeah, and, you know, of course, the personnel... There are a lot more personnel in Yosemite now than there were in those days, but there were probably several hundred permanent spots in Yosemite National Park when I went there.
Okay.
And I went there as a, I have to make sure I do this right, I think. I went there as a GS-9. Thinking that I was a park technician. And I never really looked, you know, I got to be cavalier, and I never really looked at the personnel papers themselves. as it turns out, I was transferred there as a park ranger, and in those days there was a significant difference. Now, you basically did the same things, but in theory there was a different degree of education necessary. You had different responsibilities at higher levels if you were a ranger versus a technician. Technician was supposed to be, more skilled in certain field areas. So I was sort of a weird combination, I think. But I went there, I believe, as a GS-9. Again, as the shift supervisor. Now, I think those guys are GS-12s. And to some degree, they still have that same organizational, configuration. But I had a lot of people working night shift. There were lesser people on the day shift, but there were still a significant number.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a interesting time. I mean, it was terribly nonstop. I mean, it was one call after another, lots of action, fire alarms going off, search and rescue incidents, law enforcement.
So really different from Death Valley, which would have been super quiet in comparison.
Yeah.
This, I think we're getting to a good place to stop this part five interview.
Okay.
But I did want to ask you, I think this is could fit in well, what did Ann do?
Well, throughout that entire time, I mean, she did a lot of different things. She started out as a campground fee collector.
Okay.
Pretty quickly, she became a dispatcher, and the dispatch office was right, literally within a minute of my, walking from where my house. So she was a dispatcher for a number of years. She ended up her time in Yosemite as the secretary for the United States Magistrate.
Oh, okay.
Otonello was his last name.
How do you spell that?
Otonello, Otonello. And I'd have to look or think about his first name. It's always Judge.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Great. Because I have a bunch of questions for you here. So we've been going for about 1:15 here, I guess. A little more. That's all right. Unless there's anything else you think is important to put in this interview, we'll stop here and pick up again at this point.
Well, I'm just trying to real quickly go through my little brain on
transferring over from Death Valley.
My time in Death Valley. I mean, there were things that took place, but not enough to warrant,
mm-hmm.
Although, Murphy's Law is, of course, as soon as we hang up and I'll talk about something
important. Well, we can segue that into part six, into the start of part six.
Yeah.
Okay. Great. Okay. Well, with that, this will conclude part five of a Grand Canyon Oral History interview series with Butch Farabee. Today is June 11th, 2020. My name is Tom Martin. And Butch, thank you so very much.
My pleasure. Talk to you later.